it's been years of keeping the cassettes out of direct sunlight. That's been a massive job. There's so many of them.
Are they actually your personal collection of cassettes that are being used?
Well, they are, because we actually taped, except for the first 3 weeks of the show, we taped every episode on an individual VHS cassette, because that was really good sound quality back in the mid-90s. So we had, when we finished the show after 4 years, we had something like 1,100 VHS cassettes, which, like, wow. I don't know if you know what that looks like, but it's about 30 boxes the size of a minibar fridge. And we've been unable to get the archive people to take. It's just too big a job to transfer 1,100 two-hour VHSs, because you have to do it all in real time.
Of course.
But I, at the same time, when we did that show, every night I would transfer what I thought were the best bits onto a cassette, and high-quality cassette. And at the end of 4 years, I had 185 90-minute cassettes with quite detailed sort of track listing. So when the archive found out about this about a month ago, they said, well, that's more manageable. we can transfer those at least. But even that takes, because you can't drag and click them, you have to transfer them to digital in real time. It's still a massive job.
So they will be digitalised?
They will be, yeah. They've got, and I've given them all, they've got all of Get This as well, the show I did in the noughties for 2 years. So it's amazingly commercial. I don't know what the story is at the ABC, but commercial radio is not, you know, very well archived. I mean, they tell me that people will often call up going, have you got an example of, you know, Doug Mulray from 1987, and they haven't got anything because people didn't used to keep radio shows.
It was recorded over for the next thing.
That's right. I remember when we started Martin Malloy, Fox FM in Melbourne, they would tape the shows for legal reasons on 5 VHSs, which they would rotate Monday to Friday, and we had the idea of, hey, let's, you know, because we were doing quite elaborate production and live sketches with, you know, huge amount of sound effects, and we went, let's just start keeping everyone, and everyone, we were mocked. It was such a vain thing to do, to keep your show every day. And then it was sort of like, we were kind of the laughing stocks of the station as these piles of VHS cassettes piled up. But then I remember we went on holiday for a week and we were able to make a really quite detailed best of program from those tapes to run while we were away, and suddenly you could just feel everyone in the station going, hang on a second. And then suddenly everyone was taping their shows from then on. But now, of course, you can just store everything digitally and it doesn't take up any space, any physical space.
Were other people recording their programs with the same fastidiousness as the track listings? I have seen you've tweeted a photo of your track listings on each cassette. It's quite impressive.
I don't think they were, because me and Mick were, because we did such a lot of, it was quite an elaborate show with sound effects and things. And I was very inspired by the Goon Show when I was a kid, where I always remember, you know, they would have someone would take like a minute and a half to fall down a flight of stairs. I used to love that sound effects. That was quite innovative, the sound effects on the Goon Show. So we tried to do a lot of that ourselves, and then we decided to start putting out our, we did three albums, which I think, I remember at the time, each one, when it came out, broke the world record for the world's longest comedy album. Not world's best. It was quantity. We were committed to quantity. There's no way you could make those albums unless you'd kept quite detailed, you know, listings of where all the good bits were.
But they were pen and paper listings. Again, not digital as we would expect today.
No, they're quite, it's quite an amazing, I just found them all, you know, they've been, every time I move house, it's a massive job to move all these boxes, because I've also got cassettes of Bull Twang, which is a show me and Mick did back in 1990, and then the D Generation did a breakfast show in Melbourne for 5 years back in the 80s, and I've kept, sadly those shows weren't kept, but I've got all the sketches, the pre-recorded sketches, which were incredibly elaborate as well, and so I've got those on cassette, and, you know, it's a lot to move. When I move house, you've never seen as many boxes of cassettes being carried around.
Well, I confess I own a copy of the Brown album on cassette, if you're short one of those.
Yes, that's right. It did come out on cassette. The Brown album, I always remember us telling the day we had to tell Michael Gudinski what the cover was. We just went, it's just Brown. nothing else. He wasn't impressed.
Well, at the time, I thought, well, this is what I want to listen to in the car, so I had to have it on cassette.
No,
there was the option.
When, when you're in your car and you had to fast forward to the next track.
Oh, what are your favourite memories from those radio shows that will now be preserved for all time?
I just remember that just doing that elaborate production was kind of the fun part for me, because no one else really did it in those days. And there's not a lot of it about even to this day, because it takes so long to do. Remember on Get This, when we would do those interviews where you cut up an interview with a politician and you change the questions, and it's incredibly elaborate. You're cutting, you're dropping breaths in to try and make it sound natural. And I remember we would spend 3 days building a 1:50 sketch that probably got played twice. So it's not very. Nobody wants to do that. No one wants to spend that much time on something. But there's something very satisfying about going to way too much trouble for something. And I think that's, listeners of Martin Malloy, I think, kind of appreciated that. It often sounded like we'd just gone to way too much trouble for some tiny little joke.
Well, and of course, often forgotten outside the radio studio. What part did your producer play in the success of the shows?
Well, we were very lucky with Martin Malloy, because we had a man called Peter Grace, who, I don't know if that name means anything to anyone, but he's kind of the Bruce Gyngell of commercial FM radio. He was the very first man to speak on FM radio back in commercial FM radio back in 1980.
Wow.
And he, I think he threw to a little River Band song. That's what he did. And he was also a stand-up comedian. So he had that great thing that you don't often find in radio, of somebody with a huge amount of radio experience, but also someone who knew comedy. And because the show was primarily a comedy, even when we did interviews, we would try and rope people into a sketch or something. So it was very much comedy based, and he was perfect for that. But we also would have to have a sketch, what's called in radio the engineer, the person who builds all the sketches. And we had a woman called Vicky Ma, who was one of the best in the business. But in those days, you would have to mix down a sketch in real time. And I remember quite a few times I would run into the studio, introduce the show, run back to production, and we'd be mixing down the song mixing down the first sketch during the first song. And we'd go, okay, how long does this song go? 3:50. How long is the sketch? 3:40. Okay, go. And we'd be racing to do it. And I remember often we wouldn't have had time to add all the sound effects. And so I remember, having buckets of water in the studio and trays with stones in them, and we would open the microphones and record the walking sound effects. If we needed someone walking, we'd actually do that live while the sketch was going out. I mean, I don't think anybody bothers with this kind of stuff anymore.
It's the way it should be done.
Yeah, well, I remember when we brought it back. I've had this thing where every decade I do a radio show and I say I want to do elaborate sketches, and everyone goes, oh, sketches are so 1980s. And then the 1990s, and when I did Get This, it was, oh, sketches are so 1990s. But I think what they really mean is they're just too much trouble. They take up too much time to build.
What do you think these shows preserved in the film and sound archives will show future generations about radio in the 90s?
Well, it's not a very... I'm not sure whether it says anything larger, because it was a very untypical show, Martin Malloy. I mean, we're often compared to Hamish and Andy, and I love Hamish and Andy, but Hamish and Andy are so likable. I remember me and Mick we did a lot of political stuff, and not with a lot of depth. I'm not saying it was, deep satire, but those were the years of One Nation and Pauline Hanson. I remember we got a lot of death threats. For a show that was so popular, we were also equally unpopular with a lot of people. But, you ask what will people think of it. It's just, there's so many names. You're listening to it and you're going, okay, who were Wah-Wah Nee? Who was Mal Colston? Who was Roy Hampson? What was the Whiskey a Go-Go bombing? There's just all these constant cultural references to things. Noel Crichton Brown, but names you can't even remember who they were.
And when we're in our 80s, we will love to listen back to them, Tony. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Cheers.